Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Now listen, you're listening to the Casterbridge podcast with a K. Don't worry about other podcasts. Let them gawp. Let them gape. Yes, did you know that we're available on Casterbridge.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com and Audioboo? Well, you do now. Good, isn't it? Ha!
This is the podcast. My name is Christian Corley. James McLean is with us this week, and here's a theme tune. Hello there, James McLean. How are you?
I'm okay. Yeah, I'm doing okay, I think. I think I am.
Okay, that's good. I'm also doing okay. Brian's not with us this week. We had planned something quite ornate for this week's podcast, and sadly we're not able to bring it to you quite yet. So we do have something interesting to talk about later on. Michael Herbert will be joining us to discuss his pamphlet on Malcolm Hulk, the 60s and 70s Doctor Who writer who was a communist. The pamphlet is, as you may be unsurprised to learn, called Doctor Who and the Communist. Listen, there's a few things been going on in the press with regards to Doctor Who over the last few days. James, how surprised are you to learn that Stephen Moffat has declared that Doctor Who has another 5 years?
Pat Munn. It's right. A name. It's a name. Last week, I mentioned the X-Files, and I mentioned a friend of mine, and he was told by someone else about the podcast, who actually listens to us, who listens to the X, who watches the X-Files, and he was lauding me at the fact that I called him my close friend, didn't name him, as if I was sort of like name-dropping, but not naming him. So I thought, right, fine, this week I will, throughout the podcast, intersperse his name, since it's such obviously such a big deal, Pat Munn, that I didn't actually name him. I just called him this great friend of mine who broke the X-Files story, Pat Munn. Anyway, so yes, Stephen Moffat. Well, Pat Munn. No, I'm not surprised because I think I said before, I think I got the impression that the renewal for Doctor Who is now done on its global success rather than its relevance to the channel. Mm-hmm. So I'm not entirely surprised that it would be, given the amount of countries it's selling to, that it would get another 5 years at all, regardless of how it does on we talked about this, didn't we, last week?
Well, we did, global.
So yeah, on that sort of ground, I'm not surprised at all with worldwide lust for Doctor Who. Yeah.
Do you think it's surprising that they've actually explicitly said for like 5 years and said, like, you know, I mean, that's quite a long number in television, isn't it, 5 years? I mean, it's a long number in Doctor Who, as we know.
It is. I mean, one could argue, and I could be wrong. I'm sure Pat Munn would tell me I'm wrong, but it could be that, you know, now it's dealing as a global commodity. Maybe it gives it a certain amount of security in acquisition sales by making a very big public announcements that this is a package which is going to be going on for at least 5 years, especially given that it doesn't sort of do sort of like, you know, large season orders, you know, it's like 13, isn't it? So maybe that's why. Maybe it's a commercial reason as much as anything else. I don't know. I mean, in the end, as much as I know people would like to see this as a testament to quality or a testament to Stephen Moffat, certainly it isn't a criticism against him at all. I think it's just a sign that the show retains popularity and they're confident with whoever's running, because it won't be him running it 5 years' time, I doubt it. They're confident within the actual format than they are actually in the production, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because they're ordering it over a period where he will no longer be involved in, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Listen, someone's just highlighted themselves on Twitter. You know how Facebook highlights people who have commented on things?
Is it Pat Munn?
No, it wasn't. No. An individual whose name will remain a secret, mainly because I've forgotten it, commented on a Casterbridge article concerning something. I think it's probably this interesting Series 9 snaps on the Doctor Who Instagram feed article that we published. And basically said, this person, I suspect that they're either an idiot or a troll or both. But they're basically saying that they haven't brought themselves, which is an odd turn of phrase, really, to watch the 12th Doctor yet. Which makes me wonder, what do you think of someone who would, not so much a troll, but if there was a genuine reason for someone to not watch Peter Capaldi as a Doctor. What do you think that could possibly be?
I would think more likely than anything, it would be that you'd lost interest in the show prior to Peter Capaldi appearing. I don't imagine there's many people who balked from watching Peter Capaldi at all on the basis that they liked Matt Smith so much. I'm sure they'd have at least given it a try just so they could get angry, if nothing else. So, yeah, I would say that person is either, as you say, trying to make a statement through hyperbole, or lost interest in Doctor Who long ago.
Hyperbole,
or never had it in the first place.
No, okay.
Okay, thank you for saving me on that before I said something racist as I normally do.
Actually, there's a thing near us, which is it's a modern sculpture. You remember when we had a government that spent loads of money on things, and things got built for apparently no reason in some cases, such as the Millennium Dome, and art installation stuff, some of which were very good and interesting and valid, and others were kind of did seem like they were just white elephants. Now here on Teesside we have this thing called Temenos, T-E-M-E-N-O-S, which is essentially it's situated next to the Riverside Stadium where Middlesbrough FC play, which is itself on Old Docklands, and it's essentially this Temenos is a giant fishing net, basically, in a kind of modern art way. And, you know, it's like 30, 40 feet long and goes up into the sky and things. But there's signs to Temenos all over the place. The problem is, it's a bit of a Greek or, you know, like a Mediterranean sort of a word. So you could quite easily think that, you know, you're taking directions to some foreign city when you see it. Because it doesn't have special AA signs. It just appears alongside the other signs. So, yeah, Temenos. Yeah, thanks for that.
It could be a planet in sort of like the Graham Williams era.
Well, it could be an unfortunate spell, a mispronunciation of Terminus as well, couldn't it?
It could be.
I like yours, actually. Graham Williams era planet, yeah.
Yeah. So will Gareth. Gareth Cabana would like that as well, if he's listening.
Yes, probably.
If he gets his nose out of bloody blankety blank for a second.
Hey, I was watching blankety blank the other night.
No, not you as well.
Yes. Well, it's an interesting experience, classic blankety blank. I was only recording them for the Les Dawson ones, but they've gone back to the Terry Wogan ones now.
I was watching, again, going a little off track, some political stuff, and BBC had a list of political videos of the past, and there was a great one of the 1983 convention, young Conservatives convention with Margaret Thatcher, where she's got Jimmy Tarbuck there and Bob Monkhouse, and Steve Davis comes onto the stage, you know, rallying the celebrities, and on comes Kenny Everett. and for people who don't remember, Kenny Everett was quite a left-wing comedian. A very smart man, passed away sadly. And he comes out. Do you remember those massive fingers he used to have?
Yeah.
He's got those on as well. And they don't realise that he's taking a mick. And he's there, standing there. So, you know, let's go to war with Russia. And then he starts waggling his finger, those massive fingers in the air, and they're all applauding him. You know, let's kick Michael Foot's cane away. And then he gets it away. And the perfect. It's worth seeing. We'll have to find it for the show notes. It's probably at the very end when Margaret Thatcher is surrounded by all these comedians, he's there behind her with his big fingers. And it's just one of those wonderful historical political moments where comedy and politics just fuse.
Well, you know, you say politics and comedy colliding, and you know, the satire tide doesn't usually happen, but it did happen, at least I suppose, with Aliens of London.
Yes, it
did. Which, yeah, I
very gentle satire.
Gentle satire. Well, no, there's some quite good satire in there, actually. I think we mentioned this a few weeks ago, with the whole, if you, you know, on one hand you've got the Iraq thing and the weapons of massive destruction / weapons of mass destruction, and then you've got the more niche area of conspiracy theories with the people running the country really being green aliens in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, listen, you know Andy Frankenmalen, who wrote Forgotten Son, the Lethbridge Stewart book. Well,
yep.
Well, he has written a short story as well, which is, well, it's part, well, it was in the .2 magazine in February, called The Ambush, and it is joined by We Won't Let Him Down, What Lies Beyond, a brief look at some .2 novels that feature the Brigadier, an interview with Graham Harper about Nick Courtney, the original prelude to The Forgotten Son, and The New World, the opening chapter of The Forgotten Son, in a new free ebook from Candy Jar Books. Now, what's interesting about this is that this, I mean, this is interesting to get a free ebook, and it's got a lot in there. And if you don't want it to be free, because maybe you don't want it to be PDF, maybe you want to have it on your Kindle, then you have to pay 99p to get it from Amazon, because there's a minimum fee on Amazon for putting things in, unless you have a special arrangement for something to be free. So, that's available now, so you find the show notes and get a look at that. But what's also interesting is that they had initially listed a schedule which included David A. McKinty's Schizoid Earth and Mutually Assured Domination by Nick Walters and Horror of Death Send by Lance Parkin, but it's been announced today that this week that Lance's book will not be joining the range at this point. It's been put off for the time being. So, Andy is writing a book with none other than Terence Dix.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, you might have heard of him. Yeah, he was a Doctor Who script editor and scriptwriter in the 60s and 70s. That's quite... that's a really good addition to the range. I mean, if you're going to... you know, as you may know, dear listener, James and I are both big fans of Lance Parkin. So to learn that he's... not able to contribute at this time is a bit disappointing, but a replacement like Terence Dix is quite a coup in some ways, isn't it?
It's brilliant. It is, absolutely. He is quintessentially classic Doctor Who, isn't he?
He is. Well, classic Doctor Who
and UNIT. Essentially.
But yeah, you're right, yeah. He's not actually classic Doctor Who, but he's of that era, of that vintage.
My target book range disagrees.
Okay, then. well, mine probably does as well, actually, looking at it. But that's neither here nor there.
But there are some other good people in that range as well.
Yeah, Ian Marter.
Ian Marter, yeah. He did very good stuff.
Andrew Smith did a really good job adapting his own. Full Circle as well.
Yes, David Whittaker, obviously.
Of course, yes.
David Whittaker was good. Ben Arinovich did a great Remembrance of the Daleks.
Yes, he did. Let's move on then. We'll as mentioned earlier at the top of the show. Hey, the top of the show. It's proper radio. It's just a podcast, so it's not. I told you that that we're going to be joined by Michael Herbert. It's a slight lie because I've actually spoken to him already. So, in a kind of linear sense, you're about to be joined by Michael Herbert, but I've already spoken to Michael Herbert about Doctor Who and the Communist.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, Christian.
How are you?
Very well. Nice to speak to you.
Nice to speak to you too. After all this time, as well. Now you've been working very hard on this pamphlet concerning Malcolm Hulk and his kind of, I don't know whether the right word is a double life, but his political leanings as a communist.
Yes, he was, I've not been able to establish exactly how long he was a member of the Communist Party for, but he was certainly known as a communist, though I struggled to find anything in writing by him, which as a man who made his living out of writing is quite surprising. So I looked through the Daily Worker and other publications, but couldn't find anything by him. But he was certainly a member of the party for a time, and that clearly influenced some of his kind of ways he approached writing, I think. So the pamphlet I did, which came out in January, was called Doctor Who and the Communist, Malcolm Hulk and His Career in Television. And he looks at some of the lesser-known aspects of his work as a writer, looking at how he started in the 1950s working for Armchair Theatre. And it was through that, I think, he got to know Sidney Newman. And then Newman commissioned him and his fellow writer at the time, Eric Pace, to write a science fiction series called Pathfinders in Space in the late 50s, early 60s. So that was really his kind of first entry into writing science fiction, which was a quite successful TV series aimed at young people. In many ways, it was a kind of predecessor, I think, of Doctor Who, because it was aimed at explaining science to younger people and incorporating it within an adventure kind of context.
Okay. So, I mean, he worked on a lot of things, didn't he? I mean, obviously, Pathfinders in Space, Armchair Theatre.
And then he worked on the Avengers.
Avengers, yeah.
Which is how he got to know Terence Dix, who's another key part of Malcolm's life, I suppose, as well as Sidney Newman. I think the story I've heard is that Terence was actually just renting a room in a house where Malcolm lived. I think it was his aunt's house, and they got chatting. Terence was then a sort of appetizer copywriter.
Right.
Was aspiring to get into writing, and Mac had just been given a commission to write some episodes for The Avengers. This is about 1962, I think, in the kind of catty kind of early part of the Avengers story. So they worked together on, I think, about four or five episodes of the Avengers in that period. No. And obviously, Terence went on then to work for Doctor Who as script editor.
Yeah.
And then obviously, those connections kind of continued, and he brought in Mac to help out on various episodes of Doctor Who.
Yeah. They overlap well, though, don't they? Quite a bit. Now, what I'm interested in, I think a lot of other people will be interested in, is how... Well, no, actually, before I come to that, because it's obviously 2015, and membership of the Communist Party... I don't even know if the Communist Party of Great Britain still exists, so forgive me.
No, it's sort of folded in about 1991.
Right.
There are a couple of organisations that claim to sort of be a successor to it, but it's kind of at its height. I'd say it probably joined perhaps during the war when it was at its most influential.
Right.
And the fact that the Soviet Union helped defeat the Nazis, the Red Army, gave huge credibility to the Communist Party in Britain.
Right.
And a lot of sort of idealistic young people joined, I think. I mean, I'm guessing that's why Mac joined. They seemed to stand for a better world, and a world which was opposed. They were opposed to capitalism, and they'd seen what capitalism had done in the 1930s and led to the rise of Hitler. So a lot of young people. And also the fact that, although it was never a mass party, did have a lot of people who were writers, historians, and others, so he did have quite a strong cultural life as well. And that's also another part of Mac's story, that he worked for, was involved with the Unity Theatre in London in the 1950s as production manager, which is a socialist theatre company.
Now, I wonder, because sadly I haven't had the chance to read the pamphlet yet, so I wonder how do you pitch something like that to the modern reader, because we're talking like presenting history that's kind of been forgotten and overlooked in the last sort of 20-25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, I suppose it was trying to it's not a sort of hugely lengthy pamphlet, so it just runs through some of the main elements as much as I could find in the time available, because it originally started as an internet article, and then I kind of forgot about it, and then I was approached by Five Leaves Press, Ross Branshaw, who runs Five Leaves Press, a little independent publisher in Nottingham, sort of said to her, we quite like to put this out as a pamphlet. So I spent about a week revising it and adding bits and pieces in. So it just runs through the main aspects of what I knew about Mac, really. It's essentially his writing career. The fact that being a communist kind of would give him a strong political viewpoint. So it looks at his early writing career. And then it goes through his work for Doctor Who and tries to analyse it in some sort of way about the kind of things that he approached his writing. I suppose that one of the things that, by and large, except perhaps in the War Games, where the aliens who run the War Games are really beyond the pale in their kind of lack of humanity, but in most of his other writing for Doctor Who, it's always kind of evenly balanced. The people are sort of good and bad, and it's never a sort of one side is really bad, one side is really good. He always tries to ascribe motives to people, even if that leads them to wrong acts. So a lot of it's about relationships. As he says, Mac says, it's a very political show. Remember, politics refers to relationships between groups of people. It doesn't necessarily mean left or right.
Yeah.
So if the other group of people are reptiles, they're still a group of people. So he tried to show that there are all sort of conflicting motives in what drives people into what might appear to be wrong actions. And the Doctor is often shown as trying to resolve some of those contradictions. When, like, when he first meets a Silurian, he says, "What do you people want? How can we help you? Unless you tell me what you want, the humans will destroy you." Which in the end is what happens at the end of Silurians.
How, oh, no, the fact that it's, I'm tickled by this, and I'm sure many other people are, and I don't know whether it's, I'm sure it's not completely intentional from what you've told me, but the fact that it is a pamphlet.
Yeah.
And a lot of communist writings, and not just communist writings, lots of kind of individuals who've had political aspirations have published pamphlets. So the fact that it's about a communist and it is a pamphlet is kind of a nice kind of in-joke. But how long is it actually?
7,500 words. That was right. So it comes to 32 pages rather neatly. Yeah. So that was what the publishers said they could afford.
Okay.
But you're right. I mean, there's still a market for pamphlets nowadays. I mean, in the era of endless websites and online text, nevertheless, there still seems to be a desire for people to actually pick something up and take it away and read it at their leisure or on the train. So I think Five Leaves Press seem to find that there's still a demand for sort of small-scale pamphlets that sort of limited run that would sort of attract attention, particularly if it's on a specialist area, which Doctor Who clearly has a sort of large sort of niche market, really, isn't it, though? There are people who will read anything about Doctor Who, really, whatever it's about.
If we take Malcolm Hawke's career, is not the right word, but his life as a member of the Communist Party, and then we take Doctor Who, now you've already reflected on things about our relationships and politics. Is there anything that you would say in hindsight or in any way whatsoever, maybe in novelizations, that smacks of someone who is a communist has written this line or this storyline, this aspect?
Not in a sort of overt way, because I think overt propaganda doesn't really work as an art form. Sure. But I think if you looked at his approach, he's kind of I think Terence Dick says that Macklin was always kind of suspicious of the establishment, mm-hmm. and often, quite often, in the various scenarios in his writing, there is a kind of often an establishment conspiracy or cabal or cover up, like in Ambassadors of Death, there's a kind of secretive cabal of politicians and military men who are trying to sort of kidnap the aliens and force them to carry out robberies, and you get the same in Invasion of the Dinosaurs. There's a kind of secret group of politicians. Yeah. Scientists and army officers, including Mike Gates, who want to kind of return the Earth to a golden age. So he's often quite suspicious, I think, about what's really happening, to how much do we really know about what's really going on. And so I suppose you could say in the war games, really, that gradually what you appear to be the First World War turns out to actually be a cover, but something else is really going on behind it. So I think maybe that approach to the storyline is something you might sort of say is characteristic of the left. What you see isn't necessarily what's going on.
Absolutely. We probably don't need to be on the left to think that.
people may have complete faith in their rulers, I don't know. I don't mean many people who are do think that, really.
No, certainly not in my neck of the woods, anyway. I think on the 9th, is it the 19th of April?
That's right, Christian.
Yeah, the 19th of April, and at the Fab Cafe, there's Terence Dix is going to be speaking about Malcolm Hawke.
Yes, very pleased that he's able to come up and spend an afternoon with us. And they obviously work very closely together on Doctor Who. Max seems to have been drafted in by Terence to rescue, and like the Ambassadors of Death, after David Whittaker had sort of got nowhere with it.
It's a superb piece of work for what is essentially kind of a hodgepodge as well, isn't it?
Yes. It kind of runs out of steam, but there are kind of quite exciting bits. But you can see where they got have added bits in. And I suppose the same goes with the War Games, doesn't it? That they had like 10 weeks to fill. And I think they did a really good job on it. But even I've lost count of the number of times the Doctor gets captured and then escapes and captured again. So sometimes there is a bit of filling going on. But I think there is a strong story. There's hardly a moment when something isn't happening. So it's a much underrated story, really. Which people should. Luckily, we got it back, so we're able to sort of watch it again and enjoy it.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
I think the sort of Max work tends to be of a you know, he was working in the late 60s, and then he works with Terence Dix. And but after, when Tom Baker takes over, then he doesn't write anything more for Doctor Who. So he's not asked by Robert Holmes or Philip Hinchcliffe to come in and write anything for them. So I'm not aware that he was ever approached again after the Invasion of the Dinosaurs. That's the last thing he writes, which is, let's see, 1974. Hmm. So although he died in 1979, so he could have written more, but for whatever reason, it wasn't whether he was identified with the previous era and they wanted to have new writers, I'm not sure.
Could be. Yeah. So the event on the 19th, you're obviously looking forward to it.
Yes, it'd be great to sort of have Terence come up, and I'll be contributing a bit about his early life, the bits perhaps that are less well known about his writing for Pathfinders and Press, Pathfinders in Space and The Avengers, to try and put his work in a bit more context. But obviously, I'd be very pleased to hear what Terence remembers. And in the various interviews that Terence has done for the release of the DVDs, he's always paid tribute to the influence of Mac. And his sort of... I think the other thing about Mac Holt's work is he was very keen to demystify writing. He definitely, I think he thought of it as not a kind of high and mighty thing, but a sort of practical craft. So he wrote, with Terence, he wrote about how Doctor Who was made, which one of the first books to actually explore how the programme was made. Yeah. This is an era when there was nothing really about how TV was made, and obviously there was no DVDs and special features. So this book kind of explained how the programme worked, I think, and its history. And then he also wrote something in his latter years, Writing for Television, which again explains in very great detail how you go about writing scripts for TV. So I think he was very keen to explain to anybody who was interested that it's not that hard if you've got ideas.
Hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm fortunate enough to be visiting Fab Cafe on the 19th of April.
All right, it'll be great to meet up.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think it'll be a nice afternoon.
I think it will. It's good to be able to I don't get to go to many of the events that Gareth Cavanagh's involved in putting together. These days, so we'll be since having children mainly. So I'll be nice to get down there, and absolutely to speak to you as well, Michael. Well, thank you for taking the time to speak to us.
It's been a pleasure, Christian, and I look forward to meeting you on the 19th.
And you too. Okay.
Take care. Bye now.
So a big thanks to Michael for joining us on the podcast this week. I'm really looking forward to attending the event in Manchester at the Fab Cafe on the 19th of April. And do you know who's going to be there, James?
You.
Yeah, I'll be there, yeah. Terence Dix will be there, as we've discussed, and Gareth Cavanagh's organised the event as well. And you should probably guess Michael Herbert will be there. But also going to be there at the moment, unless he changes his mind in a fit of... Scouse okay. Peak, Anthony Dry is going to be there.
Oh, wow, that's a blast from the past.
Well, yeah, I haven't seen Anthony in person for a few years, so that will be quite interesting. I'm looking forward to that immensely, as the Doctor might say.
Are you looking forward to exchanging comments on how age has affected you both?
On how what has affected us?
Age.
Age?
You know, it's like poking each other's skin to see if it's got a little more leathery in the last few years.
Well, no, mine,
a tooth, see if they're in there.
Mine hasn't. I look fantastic for my age, even if I say so myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do say so for myself. I bump into people from school quite often. I think, crikey. I'm not going to mention any names because that would be rude. But I do seem to have had a less tough paper round than a lot of people.
Good on you.
Yes, good on me. Yes, my sister has it as well. It must just be a genetic thing. I'm not making it sound like it's just me. My mum is nearly. How old's my mum? She's over 65, but not 70, and you'd think she was probably 15, 20 years less than that. So it's definitely family. My dad, on the other hand, seems to have the wrinkles of the rest of us. So you know,
I'm sure he's glad that you've said that.
Oh, he won't mind. Hi, Dad. He does listen from time to time. shall we we've got a load of stuff on Casterbus this week, which is scheduled. We've got some interviews coming up, and we've got a nice look at a convention, and we've got some video clips, but I can't really say what they are at the moment because I don't know in what order they're going out. So it's but do look out for some interviews with comic book writers from Titan Comics from the 11th and 10th Doctor series. I'm sure they will be very interesting. And you should have already seen one with Kevin Scott when we previewed the 9th Doctor miniseries, which kicked off last week. But for now, I think we're in the second half of the podcast, of the closing quarter of the, or third of the podcast, depending on how you are with maths and segmented team sports. So recommendations time. James, would you like to go first or second?
I'll go second.
You'll go second. Okay, I'll go first with this week's podcast recommendations. Now then, have I watched any Doctor Who in the last week since we last spoke? I don't believe I have, but what I have been watching is I've been subjecting myself, and I do use that term accurately, to Primeval Series 3. Now, I've mentioned Primeval previously on the podcast, and whereas the first two series were an interesting diversion from Doctor Who, like doing the whole Monster of the Week thing in a completely different way, Series 3 starts off strongly, but then basically it's as if the news that Douglas Henschel was leaving the cast was met with complete, more or less professional suicide by some of the writers and the showrunners in charge, because basically once he's gone, other than a James Moran episode, which introduces his replacement character, played by Jason Fleming, the series doesn't really recover until the following year. I mean, this is Series 3 is the point where ITV decided to put Primeval in the can.
Yeah.
And the series, even with a relatively strong finale, the series doesn't recover until the following year when they bring in Kieran McMenamin as the new head of research team at the Ark. So I mean, Ben Miller, fortunately, is in there throughout the five series, and it's Series 4 where it manages to get back into its stride. But seriously, it's a massive disappointment. It's really a shame. I have been. I mean, I would recommend it for the first few episodes and to see what happens when a show totally gets it wrong, when it can't cope with the replacement of its lead actor, which obviously is something Doctor Who has never had a problem with for obvious sci-fi reasons. But, you know, there's plenty of other shows that get away with replacing lead actors, such the CSI, the very CSIs have replaced their lead actor in a couple of examples, haven't they?
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, it's not impossible. The X-Files, would you say the X-Files got away with it?
I think it depends who you speak to.
Okay.
I think so.
Okay. So that's that. I've also been... this isn't a TV program or anything like that. I've started the first Game of Thrones book, but I can't really say much about that because I've only read the prologue for now. But what I have been doing, and you'll be interested in this to some degree, James, because it's a guitar thing. You know Rock Band and Guitar Hero, those games with the plastic guitar controllers? Well, they're kind of yesterday's news, okay? Even though they're bringing out new versions of one or two of them, are you? They are yesterday's news. Where, if you want to play guitar in a video game, what you need to get is Rocksmith, okay? There's a few versions. It's been out for a few years now. I've just got hold of Rocksmith 2014. And basically, it's a game that comes... it's available on Xbox, Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, and Windows. I suspect it's probably out on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One as well. You get a special cable with it, which is a jack to USB, but it's not like a standard jack to USB. It's got a special box in the middle of it. And basically, it's the Guitar Hero paradigm. You know, it's that whole dynamic where you're playing along with the song, but you're actually playing along with the actual notes on an actual guitar, which the game tunes for you. The game is full of lessons. There's little kind of 16-bit arcade games to help you combining those two things, you know, video games are traditionally very fast things, such as a chord change or a lick or a riff in some cases. So there's games where you have to hit a chord quickly in order to shoot down a spaceship. So you like display this chord, you hit the chord, and then your spaceship shoots another spaceship. So there's those things in there, and then there's the whole Rock Band Guitar Hero thing going on as well. If that doesn't sound intriguing enough, when you start playing the song for the first a song for the first time. There's a big library of songs, well-known tracks that you'll know, and there's other ones that you can download for a small fee. But the, I mean, the initial library is huge to start with. You start with just basic notes, maybe, you know, one every 10 seconds or one every bar or whatever. And as you become more competent, it throws in more notes for you to deal with. And if you get into trouble, then it'll take a few out and then it'll bring them back in later on. You can try again. And you can even just practice particular passages and even slow down the song. Basically, this is a brilliant tool for anyone who's either wants to learn guitar or refresh. Hello, that's me. Their guitar playing. And you know, I spent 3 hours of it in total since the weekend. If you haven't played it and you want to get back into playing guitar or want to learn guitar, don't pay for lessons. Get that, basically, because it's fantastic. So that's my recommendation. Yes, thank you. What have you got?
Thunderbirds.
All right.
That aired its new version this week on ITV, I think. Caught it on ITV Player. Very good. You know, Casualty is... Sorry, I was going to say Thunderbirds is an overblown version of Casualty, but it's more Casualty. It's Thunderbirds. They're very, very similar TV shows. And that's when I realised, when I saw Thunderbirds for the first time since I was a kid in the 90s, I realised that's what it was. But it does it very well. It's a very good remake. If you're into remakes, it's,
I've seen some mixed reviews, so I'm gratified that you think it's worth watching.
Well, there's a couple of things they've changed. You know, they've updated Tintin, so she's not some sort of like waitress or questionable multiple romantic partnered girl for all the brothers in some dubious European porno flick. I don't know. That's all gone. But things like, you know, the launching of the Thunderbirds is almost, it's faster, but it's almost frame by frame authentic to what they used to do. Even down to that little blast shelter, which is sort of...
Oh, the back of Thunderbird 2. How would you compare it to the Captain Scarlet remake that they did in the similar medium?
I think it's better. I think
There's
a Clipper Stingray, there's a ship that looks like an eagle from Space 1999. And as I was just trying to say, there's a lot of attempts to look like models, you know, puppet models, like the landscapes sometimes look like they've, you know, maybe model makers, which is a very nice touch. So yes, watch the Thunderbirds. It's on the ITV Player, I think, at the moment, so you can watch it for free if you're British.
Okay, well, we'll link to that. Okay, so, well, I mean, that brings us to the end of this week's Posterbris Cadpost. Casterbris Podcast with a K. Big thank you to James, and a big thank you to you, dear listener, too, because you may have had a few audio issues with James's voice. He is actually in the process of being cybernized. John Lomich knocked on his door last night, and he hasn't been the same since. So thank you to James, thank you to you, dear listener, and we'll be back next time with another podcast. Until then, goodbye. Oh yeah, theme tune. Do the theme tune now, don't I?